Going beyond the headlines to the deeper issues. 96.3 WHUR and HUR Voices, Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside Segment, where your questions and comments matter at 202-319-7810. Join the conversation.
Welcome back to the Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight, we are addressing issues regarding sexual assault. It is one of the most violent and most underreported crimes committed. What is preventing victims from speaking out? We're examining the questions surrounding sexual assault tonight, as well as the role that men can play in addressing it. My guests are Chandra Robinson, Deputy Director of the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, and Neil Irvin, Executive Director of Men Can Stop Rape. If you have any comments, if you have any questions, if you need help, if you have been a victim of sexual assault recently or not so recently and still are trying to figure out where to turn, definitely give us a call. Lines are open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Chandra, Neil, thank you both for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk a little bit about why it is so difficult for victims of sexual assault to report the crime.
That's a question that's an individual question for each survivor. It's a variety of different factors that play into reporting. There could be safety issues. Disclosure or reporting could result in further victimization by the perpetrator. There are cultural ramifications for individuals that represent marginalized populations, such as African American and Latino populations, possibly involving police and criminal justice system, opens up or exposes them to other safety concerns outside of sexual assault. And so, for example, for my Latino population, that's an immigration issue. What we know about sexual assault is this is an issue of power and control, and the perpetrator can have areas of power and control that go beyond just the sexual violence itself. So if this is someone I know, if this is my boss, reporting doesn't, while it means accountability on one area, it also means a loss, possible loss in other areas, such as income, housing. And so that's an individual question that varies from survivor to survivor.
For the sake of argument, because you've mentioned several categories mm-hmm. there, but for the sake of argument, let us assume that the victim, mm-hmm. which is a woman, which is the lion's share, but not always. Right. And she does not know her attacker, mm-hmm. has no interaction with him at all. He's not familiar to her. Mm-hmm. Why would she then still be reticent to report what has happened?
And again, it's still an individual circumstance. I think with that, there are other aspects to disclosure. There's the emotional aspect that goes with disclosure, the shame. We live in a society, as much as what we know about sexual assault, there's still a great deal of ignorance within the community. And the sense of the victim blaming, and not to mention, while nationally, we've made great strides in supporting survivors, it is still a system that is not completely survivor-friendly. So telling my story and have to tell my story multiple times to each person and recanting it, that's equally traumatic, if not more. And so all those things are weighed when one considers, do I want to disclose? And for some, it's just they don't see the need to. Now, with that, you know, that can be a difficult concept for some, but for those of us to do the work, accountability does not require disclosure.
Explain that.
So, for example, a survivor, especially in working in a therapeutic setting, a survivor can work with a licensed, trained clinician and work on accountability. And what I mean by that is it is the perpetrator's responsibility. He or she gets to take the onus of victim, or what we like to say, survivor. The perpetrator committed the offense. The perpetrator, it had nothing to do with what I wore, where I was, what I drank. And so accountability does not require disclosure, because I've seen the reverse where survivors have disclosed and reported and they still take the onus of responsibility for what happened. So those are two separate things.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the many complex issues surrounding sexual assault. This is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, and we're talking about the support that the survivors of this heinous crime need to report and to also address some of the internal struggles that they may have even after this crime is perpetrated upon them. If you have a comment, if you have a question, give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Neil, one of the things that your organization, Men Can Stop Rape, represents is a growing number of men who are becoming aware of the importance of this issue. Talk to me a little bit about that.
You know, I think that growing number is, you know, an ongoing, sustained effort that we have been championing and leading not only in the District of Columbia, but in Mid-Atlantic region and across the country, where most of us as men are not perpetrating violence against the people in our lives and our community. And so what we're saying to men and have been saying now for the last 21 years, it's not good enough to know what many of us already know, that you're not supposed to harm people, you're not supposed to sexually assault your girlfriend, your partner, your wife, a stranger. It's not good enough to just not know that and not do those things. But as men, promoting healthy masculinity and the characteristics that we feel are valuable about what makes us men, we have to get involved every day in our daily lives with our peers and our community to not only role model the kinds of masculinity that we think it's going to take to prevent sexual assault, but to really be present in the lives of our neighbors and our community so that people can witness our absolute commitment to preventing all forms of men's violence against girls and women.
What is healthy masculinity?
Well, it's a great question. One thing you will not hear us discuss that Men Can Stop Rape is toxic masculinity. We believe that it's becoming like a buzzword. It's becoming like conspiracy theory. Healthy masculinity, if you talk to a physician, he may say it's diabetes or heart health. If you talk to an educator, they may say it's high school graduation or college graduation. For us, we look at healthy masculinity as comprehensive skill building for the development of individuals. We look at our social emotional intelligence. We work on teaching boys and young people about understanding empathy, sympathy, compassion, anger, rage, and being able to recognize those and incorporate the skills necessary to navigate those and become good decision makers and ultimately leaders in their community that really lift up the kind of manhood that we believe it takes to prevent gender-based violence.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. We are talking about sexual assault and Sexual Assault Awareness Month, giving victims the support they need to address these issues. Let's go to Anthony. Anthony calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Anthony. What's on your mind?
Thank you, Harold. I really appreciate you for hosting this topic tonight. I'm calling as a male survivor. I survived both childhood and adult sexual assault. My most recent one was 2 years ago. And within the time period before that occurrence, I had been assaulted several times by the same perpetrators. When it happened back in 2017, I just decided that I couldn't just sit back and let it happen again, and I decided to report. And so I just wanted to call and share some of the things that kind of kept me from reporting. And really, it was four key things that you all have already addressed, but it was shame. You know, what would people think about me? You know, was I gay because I was assaulted, or did I become gay because of the assault? And stigma and masculinity. And so I really think that, you know, just looking back in hindsight, that I'm glad that I did what I did, you know, as far as reporting it, because I blamed myself at first.
Well, Anthony, let me stop you there, because I want to give my guests an opportunity to respond. Chandra, you were nodding your head when he was running down the list. Your thoughts on what Anthony was sharing?
Well, first I want to acknowledge Anthony's survivorship. Appreciate him calling and walking, sharing his experience with the world. And so I know that's no small thing in healing. You know, DCRCs, we always say there's no straight path to healing. And so I definitely understand what the journey looks like. And it is not uncommon for a survivor to be at different places along the journey. If you listen to Anthony, at one point he didn't want to disclose. At another point he decided to disclose. And that takes time. Now, unfortunately, we don't live in a system in a world where the laws are set up all the time where you get to take all that kind of time. And then hold a perpetrator accountable. Now, that's a different conversation, but I definitely wanted to acknowledge that. And so I'm nodding. A lot of what he said resonates with me in terms of what I've seen professionally. What we see with adult sexual assault when we work with survivors, childhood sexual assault is very common. That is something that's often left out the conversation. We have conversations about childhood sexual assault, and we have separate conversations about adult sexual assault. We're not having enough conversations about the correlation between the two. So when he said that, I was nodding my head because this is something that we at the DC Rape Crisis Center are very strongly advocating about and trying to bring back to our conversations. The other piece to it is the shame, is the stigma. I think especially for male survivors, the questions of regarding one's sexual orientation are common, very common. It happens. One is blamed because of their sexual orientation. And all of these are things that contribute to one's decision just to keep quiet.
Anthony, thank you so much for your courage in sharing with us. We certainly appreciate you. I'm coming up on a break, but before I go to a break, I need information from both of you that you can share with our listeners for those who may need counseling, support, where they can find information about the D.C. Rape Crisis Center on the web. Please go right ahead, Chandra.
So website, we are www.dcrcc.org.
One more time, D.C.?
dcrcc.org.
Okay. And as always, we'll make sure that information is on our website also. Neil, your organization, please.
Is at www.mencanstoprape.org.
MenCanStopRape.org. I really appreciate it. 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk to Gail, calling from D.C., Carolyn, calling from D.C. Lines are still open. We are talking about providing support for sexual assault victims. This is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so please give us a call. We will be taking your phone calls even after 7:30 at 202-319-7810. Stay with us. The Daily Drum will continue on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Jeff Brown is next with The Quiet Storm on WHUR. We will continue this conversation on Sirius XM Channel 141 in just a few seconds.
The Howard University Radio Network is WHUR 96.3 FM, WHUR World 96.3 HD2, student-run WHBC HD3, GlassHouseRadio.com, SiriusXM Channel 142, HBCU and SiriusXM Channel 141, HUR Voices, Washington.
Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we are examining the issues surrounding one of the most heinous and most underreported crimes. We're talking about sexual assault. My guests are Chandra Robinson, Deputy Director of the D.C. Rape Crisis Center, and Neil Irvin, Executive Director of Men Can Stop Rape. We are taking your phone calls, so if you're having difficulty getting through, I promise we will get to you. Just please keep trying. All of your phone calls, particularly tonight, are very, very important. Let's go to Gail. Gail calling from D.C. Gail, thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi. Thank you for the conversation tonight. And what was important to me to call in was that when this happened to me years ago, the problem that I faced was the shame of telling that I had been sexually assaulted, because it was like no one believed me, and I became the person who was just there and someone had taken advantage of me and no one believed me. But today's society, I would pray that we would look at this at a different side, and that women can have an avenue to be able to come forward to see that they can get help, and that they are not the ones that are there and have perpetrated this because of them being in a place, but that it actually happened. And I lived with this for many years. Now I have accepted it, that it wasn't my fault, and I can move on with a clear mind. So thank you for this conversation, and I hope that we can move forward in society to get help for not only the males, but for the females as well. And well, thank you so much.
Well put, Gail. Thank you so much. Carolyn calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Carolyn. What's on your mind?
Hi. You know, I chimed in on the conversation. I'm born and raised here in the District of Columbia, and I, too, was a victim at the age of 14. And it's always the perpetrator's fault, because innocent people do not deserve to be raped, you know, to be victimized at no time. And what I did was I was afraid to tell. But what I did was pray that the perpetrator got caught someday, you know. And I feel like, you know, for the ones who, for the other people who have experienced the same thing, you know, there's help. Seek help. Because I did. And I've overcame, you know, what had happened to me. And I also forgave that person because they're sick. There's a lot of sick people out here. But people need to say something, you know. Don't be afraid.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much, Carolyn. You make an excellent point. You know, one of the things Carolyn and the previous caller brought up that I think needs to be addressed, because over the past generation, we have seen a change in how, first of all, sexual assault may be defined. I think historically, sexual assault may be considered a relatively new term. It was just rape. Okay. But now, sexual assault has a very, very broad definition. So help me with that. Some people may assume that this may have to involve sexual organs, while in some cases it may be, you know, someone may be grabbed on the rump, and that is still legally considered sexual assault. What has happened with that?
Well, I would say to you that our social norms have changed, and we've become more informed about the continuum of violence that is experienced by all or many of us in our society. And I think there are more resources to help continue that education. So, yes, I'm not a lawyer, but there are different rules and laws in every jurisdiction that speak to what the legal definition of sexual assault, and Sandra could speak to that far better than I, to, as what you said, all the way down to unwanted touching or unwanted contact. And so we've gotten more sophisticated, and I would say more informed about the multiple ways in which sexual assault happens. And I think that's to our credit in this area and across the country.
Definitely. I think also it has evolved, and how it's perpetrated has evolved. And so we've had to go back and reexamine the definition thereof. And so, you know, generations ago, social media was not an issue. We weren't talking about sexual assault via social media and laws to support survivors in that aspect. And so I think that is one of the challenges to this kind of work. We always have to be on the cusp in front of it, staying abreast and to know what's going on. I think with the evolution of the definition, which it requires creative collaborative efforts, so such as DCRCC and With Men Can Stop Rape, those kind of years ago we wouldn't be able to do this, but this is an issue that I always say is an epidemic, and it's beyond it can't be boxed into one organization. It can't be boxed by a movement comprised of just women. It can't. And I know that's a hard conversation for a lot of people. I said, but if we're going to address it on an epidemic level, we're going to have to do some creative things and cross some racial lines, some gender lines, some class and system lines, and collaborate. And I think that is one of the many positives of our relationship with Men Can Stop Rape. And we've been able to stay in front of this.
But is there a point at which some of the issues go too far? And this is what I refer to. There have been, over the past several years, cases in the news where children, I mean really young children, mm-hmm. 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds, have been accused of sexual assault. And we're talking about kids who can't even spell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is there more work and more discussion that needs to be done when you're differentiating between really small children and then those who absolutely should know better, adults, young adults, and even tweens who are need to be taught a lesson mm-hmm. without being, for lack of a better term, locked up?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a really complicated issue, which is why I think staying on the forefront and leading is so important. Because, again, I would say even with small children, this is learned behavior. So we always have to ask the question, where did they learn it? What is normal developmental exploration of their own bodies or inappropriate boundaries being crossed? So we don't want to over-sexualize children's play. And yet we can never allow the lack of consent, the lack of harm being perpetrated against anyone, more importantly with children, because we do know that these are learned behaviors. So I don't think all behaviors are apples to apples, and I do think we always have to be mindful, but this is where the Rape Crisis Center is such a great leader to help us understand where the boundaries are and how to continue to inform them and evolve from them.
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Denise, calling from D.C. Denise, thanks for calling. What's on your mind? Denise, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go right ahead, please.
Hi. I work for the judiciary in D.C.
Denise, I cannot hear you. Please speak up.
Can you hear me now?
There we go. Go right ahead, please.
My apologies. I work for the judiciary in Washington, D.C., and I was sexually assaulted by a contractor. I immediately reported it to my supervisor. Unfortunately, what's still in existence is the Good Old Boys Network. And what they tried to do was protect the contractor. And then I had to go through processes within the agency and learned that there were no policies in place regarding sexual assault. They never called security. They didn't call the police. When I learned of this and I contacted, it was too late because the man had left the country. So I find that that is a big challenge. It's not dealing just with the humiliation of reporting it and not being believed, but also that there are no policies in place in a lot of government agencies to protect the person who is assaulted.
Let me stop you right there, Denise, because I do have a question about that. At first blush, you know, the thing that comes to mind is, yeah, it would be nice. It would be helpful if agencies, if government agencies, D.C. or anywhere else, had policies for dealing with sexual assault. But more broadly, that should go across the board, whether it's sexual assault, coworkers robbing a coworker, coworkers assaulting a coworker. Why not just call the police? Obviously, you know, I'm not talking about her, but I'm talking about an agency or organization, governmental agency that she works for. Mm-hmm. The policy should be dial 911. Am I wrong here?
Was her name Denise is highlighting something again that's very common. You see me over here nodding my head. I get phone calls from organizations all the time who recognize that this is a serious disconnect within their organization. So mm-hmm. we're making strides. That doesn't mean we're there by no means. Mm-hmm. We're just making strides. And again, I mean, that's a complex issue. There are many agencies that do have such policies. Now, what happens is, if anybody have ever worked a part of a bureaucracy, what is happening on the policy level does not always trickle down in terms of information for those who are on the lower levels. Policies change. Policies are outdated. Agencies have various priorities. So, for example, if I work for an agency and our focus is we have a mission or mandate that just does not it's not around sexual assault. It is easy for this, and I'm not saying it's okay, it is easy for this to not be on the priority for the organization. And I see this not just in government agencies. I see this in
private
small
industry.
Yeah, this
yes.
is not a government agency issue, so I don't want to put that disclaimer. There are policy. However, I think what let me say this. Sexual harassment in the workplace does fall on the continuum of sexual assault. And I think a lot of organizations don't know that. Mm-hmm. We're still following this definition. We're looking for rape. We're looking for someone behind a bush. Mm-hmm. Sexual harassment in the workplace is part of the continuum. And there are laws. Now, unfortunately, now you're asking a survivor, if there aren't policies in place, to know how to navigate that on his or her own. That is daunting. That is daunting.
And I don't think it's, and honestly, I don't think it is fair.
I don't think it's
for a victim to mm-hmm. have to figure out how to navigate a bureaucracy. Mm-hmm. And I agree, when you're talking about sexual harassment and then sexual assault and then rape, we're talking about degrees. And so, yes, obviously a much broader conversation, whether mm-hmm. it be for governmental agencies, now, private industry, nonprofits. Go ahead, Denise, real quick.
Real quick. And I'd like to say, once I reported it and I had to push, just like she said, I had to push to change the laws, because one, they knew it happened because the guy provided a written apology. Okay. Mm-hmm. But then this is the Administrative Office of U.S. Courts. They ended up updating their HR manual. Now, what they didn't do for the person who was assaulted was treatment for them. Mm-hmm. And then they tried to cover it up because, as you know, it's been on the news that this agency, that Capitol Hill had a hearing on this same topic, and the director of the agency testified there was never a report of a sexual assault at that agency.
Okay.
And surprisingly, there's no records because they won't document it.
Okay. Well,
so how do you change that, you know, for other people to be willing to come forward knowing that their agency will not only believe, but also make sure that there are policies in place to protect them.
Well, Denise, thank you for sharing with that, and sharing with us. And she makes a really interesting point, because this isn't about one single incident. What she's talking about is a change of attitudes, a movement, a broad awareness, like we've been talking about, Neil, with your organization, of changing the way that people see this issue. And aside from, you know, we have, you know, rape and sexual assault is one thing. But the other thing I think that's really important as it relates to awareness is something you brought up earlier, the issue of consent, particularly in teaching young people specifically, but all ages, about what is appropriate. No means no, but it's more complex than that, I'm sure.
It absolutely is, and I think with our young people, it's why primary prevention is so important to us. We believe this work is from conception throughout the lifespan, and so throughout that process, we should continue to gain and understand what consent is, and how do we continue to make sure that it is voluntary, without under the influence of drugs or alcohol, and enthusiastically given at all stages of our relationships with one another. And so whether that be in the sandbox or an intimate personal relationship, it is really the requirement of all of us as a community, as a society, to do so. And again, we'd be remiss without the Rape Crisis Center's leadership, the first and oldest in the country, that continues to allow and support Men Can Stop Rape's contribution to this work by really trying to show that everything that we are trying to do as a community benefits us all.
But what does that look like? What are those conversations look like when you are talking to men about consent, or young men, teenagers, teenage yeah. boys. What do you talk to them about?
Well, I definitely first got to shout out then the Men of Strength Club, our young men who are in middle schools and high schools and all the DCPS and have for the last 21 years had direct and frank conversations about what healthy masculinity is. And those conversations with our young men are intergenerational, and so our adult facilitators offer some of the wisdom of their life experience. And we also learn that you don't say things like WWW in 2019. that we have opportunities for our young men to then be leaders in their peer groups, whether it be athletics or the SGA or in the academic clubs or just the corner boys trying not to violate probation. They have the language and the understanding of what healthy masculinity is for their peer group, and that they can have ongoing daily conversations. If it was just about a workshop or a training, we would do it for world peace. As I said, this work is for a lifetime, from conception throughout the lifespan. And so we need as many doses of what healthy examples of masculinity are and the skills that go with it. And it's just like a jump shot or a golf swing. You don't get it the first time. You have to keep practicing at it. You have to keep being accountable to it. And you have to keep desiring to be your best self. And that's what we think and have seen sustain itself for so many years now.
Is it hard for some of them to get it?
Well, you know what I would tell you, and I'll be really honest, and I'm so pleased that here in Washington, D.C., with this ever-changing landscape of this city, boys of color tend to get it very quickly.
Really?
Now, yeah, well, I think they understand injustice and oppression a lot readily. I think affluent communities also get it. It takes a little longer. There's a privilege there that they are asked to divest. That can be scary. It can be in the unconscious for most of us, as boys and men particularly. So absolutely, they get it, and I think the honesty is the thing that is most important. Teaching boys everything from how you would use a condom and how you would ask someone out on a date, how you would accept a no, and what's expected of you behaviorally if you do share an intimate moment with them. How do you gain consent? This is the answers to the test. And so I think that's what resonates with our young people. And when we were in Department of Corrections or we're at one of the fine universities in the city or working with professional athletes or private industry, I think it resonates differently with different men based on their own experiences. But for the most part, as I've said, most of us as men aren't doing these things. We're asking now for an additional requirement to not only not do these things, but to engage others and make sure that they are also accountable to not doing these things.
Chandra, what do you think about that?
Well, in listening to me, I mean, I'm a huge fan, of course, if I say that.
It's mutual.
I think one of the things I want to pull out or extract from what he said is when he highlighted this concept of privilege. And I think both DCRCC as well as Men Can Stop Rape approach this work with an anti-oppression lens. Well, sexual assault is not just an issue around sexual violence, deviant behavior or violence. We are approaching the work with a understanding of the impact of race, class, gender, and how all these things come to or intersect and contribute to the perpetuation of sexual gender-based violence. So when with that understanding, we have to have that kind of conversation and fuel that into the conversation around consent at an early age. So while he is talking about what the work looks like for populations of color, he also acknowledges what it looks like for populations from privilege, because it's important if you want to get this not just buy-in but understanding. You have to approach the work. It's not just an issue around sexual behavior. Consent is not just an issue of no. First of all, culturally, no is conveyed in many different ways.
That's right.
Not just language, behaviorally, it's interpreted different. What does no mean? No, first of all, Neil is discussing what consent looks like as far as boys getting consent. What does it look like for a young lady of color getting consent from a male? Because, again, we want to highlight that we do have male survivors. Our first caller said he was young. Well, we have this gender norm that is there.
But our first caller was assaulted by men. He was not assaulted by women.
No, but what I'm saying is that what I'm acknowledging that men are sexually assaulted,
yes.
Young boys. And with that being said, for when we're doing work with young girls, it is the same thing around consent. We get numerous calls and requests from various local schools. Well, this is a huge problem, and it's not just young boys perpetrating this. These are our young girls, and young girls are making assumptions that feed the gender norm that boys want sex. There's no need to get consent. What boy doesn't want to be touched? That goes with the norm for being a male. So this consent conversation in populations of color, population impoverished communities, looks different than what it looks like in some of our areas that don't meet those particular demographics. And so what I just wanted to extract from Neil's conversation is the distinction in how the conversation and the work is approached, because you asked what does it look like, and it varies for the population.
Thank you.
Calvin, calling from D.C. Thanks for calling, Calvin. What's on your mind? Calvin, are you there? Give me a call back if you can. One of the other issues that we've not discussed, and I think this also dovetails into the thoughts of misplaced privilege, and that has to do with date rape, because that's, you know, unfortunately, that is a relatively newer term over the past, 30 years or so. Are we still, why are we still struggling with this issue of date rape, where you may have someone, they can go out. And again, this comes down to just an issue of, no means no, not yet, not maybe next week, but not tonight. It just means right now, no. Am I right about that?
No still means no.
No still means no, and yet, the contradictory messages that we give boys, you look at it, all of our look at the socialization of boys, you look at our society, whether it be media, sports, business, no is the beginning of negotiation in many of those places. We enhance this idea that boys are supposed to really figure it out. It's a problem to solve. No may not mean no in the midst of what we've socialized boys to think about in dating relationships or in personal relationships. So I think it is really contradictory what we want them to do versus what we socialize them to do. Now, this never will excuse anyone who chooses to be violent or to harm someone, but it also does highlight it's far more complicated than just telling boys not to hit girls or not to rape, because what we're talking about is a developing adolescent brain. And when you get on a college campus, you're talking about someone who may have never learned these skills for 18 years. And next thing you know, they're in a co-ed dorm and they're in showers and bathrooms and all the things. And so that the nature of the violence then somehow gets masked differently than a stranger rape. Where it's like, oh, it's date rape, or it's not as bad. But the nature has been, the problem has been building in that young person's life for many, many years. And last thing I'll say real quickly is that, and again, most boys and men aren't doing these things even in those circumstances. It's the ones who are doing it not only once, but often regularly, and actually trying to not only get away with it, but developing strategies to do so.
And let's say that this isn't just an issue for post-adolescent and college co-eds. Grown A men, they are out there dating as well.
Correct.
And are, forcing themselves on, on women, or even, in same gender relationships, mm-hmm. Forcing themselves on people that they are dating. And so I think that, that certainly this is a much more, I would argue, this is a much more complicated issue now than it was a generation ago, because of the awareness.
Yep.
Because one of the things that you mentioned, that, and it just occurred to me, Chandra, was when you were talking about girls, mm-hmm. and I do mean girls, mm-hmm. perpetrating various and sundry levels of sexual assault, because they may be getting messages that adult women are getting about being more assertive, being more aggressive when they're dating guys, mm-hmm. and not to just kind of sit back in the cut and let him, yes, you can be a boss bee, mm-hmm. and let him know what it is that you want. But it's not so much that position as it is their response to him in that case. And what he may say if he says no.
I think because historically, when we talk about sexual assault, we are typically we've typically heard it as the female is the survivor, the male is the perpetrator. And so while we're making strides, and while it's been great work, NEAL represents the organization, and there are other organizations as such, that as well as DCRCC, that's doing work around masculinity. I think what has happened, though, and what we want to make sure is that our girls don't get lost in the conversation around accountability. This is not it now. That's separate from victim blaming, because that's a whole different thing. We believe survivors, regardless of gender.
Yes, absolutely.
However, I think we have to be careful is while we're doing great work here as it relates to educating our young boys around consent, masculinity, the problem with the norms of the past and re-education. Mm-hmm. We have to make sure we bring our daughters, and I say this as a mother, of a daughter, into the conversation around accountability too. While she's empowered to say no and how to say no and how to facilitate safety and all these precautions, likewise she's just as accountable in respecting the space of her male counterpart. And so I think we got to make sure we're balancing this conversation, because girls are not always engaged in that accountability conversation. Girls are engaged in conversations around victim blaming. Don't do this. Don't wear this to make yourself a target. Boys are typically engaged in conversations around don't perpetrate the offense.
That's right.
We need to have a equal balance in the conversation for our young folks.
And as we come to the end of this conversation, I don't want to forget the victims. What advice do both of you have for those, let's say women, for example, who have been, you know, violently sexually assaulted? I'm not talking about, you know, an HR pat on the butt in the corporate office. I'm talking about when someone is attacked, someone is forced into a sexual act or raped, you know. If they escape with their lives, what is the thing that you want them to do to protect their bodies and their minds, emotionally, their spirits, after something like this happens?
Well, I think for me, one thing I have to say, and I know you outlined the type of sexual assault. I think for the work, those of us to do the work, regardless of the type of sexual assault, it can be equally traumatic. It can, the detriment, it doesn't, one would think a small pat on the butt does not have major implications, and it can leave someone just stuck in life.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about that stereotypical, you walking down the street minding your own business and somebody snatches you in the bushes.
I think what I would begin, and I see these survivors all the time, they walk through the door, we begin with, one, it's not your fault. It's not your fault. Let's start there. And for some time, that may be the beginning of the healing process, just to help the survivor take lessen some of the responsibility. Now, am I realistic? Yes. That doesn't mean it all falls off at the door. But it's not your fault. And we applaud your courageous, your courage, and how you were willing to step forward and identify and empower yourself to feel empowered enough to navigate services, whatever that looks like. Services and supports for some is therapy. DCRC provides individual and group counseling. We have a variety of things. Survivorship may mean for some just starting and calling the hotline a couple of times just to talk to somebody and just saying, I'm a survivor. And so, again, I keep going back to this individual response, but I think if I had to come up with something that was universal across the board, one, it is not your fault. And I applaud you for taking steps in your survivorship.
NEAL, I have 20 seconds for you. What do you want to say to the men real quick?
Well, I want us to say to all of the adult men in our community that, one, we need to continue to do more. We need to continue engaging this issue on all fronts, in the workplace, at home, with our peers and our faith community. And we really need to make sure that we're role modeling what healthy masculinity needs to be in the lives of the young people in our community.
Okay. And your website again?
Is mencanstoprape.org.
Okay. And also yours, Chandra?
DC Rape Crisis Center, dcrcc.org.
Thank you so much. And, of course, resources for this conversation will be posted on our website on whur.com after 9 o'clock tonight. I want to thank both of you for coming in, NEAL Irvin and Chandra Robinson. Hopefully this conversation helps someone.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That is the Daily Drum on Sirius XM Channel 141 for this Monday, April 29th. I'm Harold Fisher. You can tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. Now, stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.